Well, good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ and our dear young people. If you have ever felt, brethren and sisters, at some period in your life that things were out of control, if you've ever felt a time in your life where you're just powerless and helpless to just put things back and on track, if you've ever felt in your life a time when you've questioned in your mind that is God's way right or not? Why is this happening to me, or why that, or why now? If you've ever felt frustrated and at the injustice that seems to be perpetrated either to you or to someone else, that seems impossible to change, if you've ever tried to untangle things in your own life or others, and tried to put plans into place only to find they come all unstuck, or have ever felt as if life is just one big long struggle. If any of those things have been part of your experience, then Jacob's life has been recorded for you. And I know it's there for me too, brethren and sisters, because I've found a great deal of comfort and a great deal of consolation and a great deal of warning and a great deal of exhortation from the life of this man. You know, the Apostle Paul said that all Scripture was there for our learning, that we through comfort and consolation might have hope, that we might come to understand the way God has dealt with individuals in the past. You know, the learning of the Scriptures is not just so that we can gather more information about this character or that. There is some purpose to it. And if it doesn't lead us to patience, as Paul says in Romans 15, and it doesn't lead to consolation and eventually to hope, then all of our learning is in vain. But we're not going to be disappointed in the life of Jacob, because the divine record, as is so often the case when historic characters are portrayed through the Scriptures, the divine record is very, very carefully selective. It's not a complete record of Jacob's life by any means, even though there's a lot said in the Scriptures about Jacob. And what we find recorded is not there just to tell us about this faithful man and all his experiences. It's not just there even to teach us just a few lessons that we might like to learn along the pathway of probation as we get to the kingdom. What Jacob's life does, brethren and sisters, and why I think it's recorded, is that it's highlighting the essential purpose of God in our lives. The essential purpose. Not just one component, not just one characteristic, not even just a couple, but it gets right at the very essence of how God works with men. And will help us, no doubt, in time, if we give this man's life and the divine record that's devoted to it our meditative time, it will help us to make sense of the experiences that otherwise we would find very difficult to make sense of in our lives. Well, we know that the great purpose of God is essentially manifestation. But you know, brothers and sisters, that central to that is the salvation of individuals, because God cannot manifest himself and his character unless it is through other individuals who have responded to him. See, God is interested in saving individuals. He is interested in doing that. Jesus came into the world that he might save sinners. It's God's will that none should perish. Of course, many will, but it's his will that none should perish. But you know, he's not just interested in saving anyone, though he would have all men come to repentance. But God's whole purpose in our lives, brethren and sisters, is to make us in the end worth saving. Not in the sense that we've got something that we can then say before God, well, now you must save me. But to get us to a point that He can actually use us, because in our natural state, we're not very much used to God at all. And so, in a nutshell, therefore, the purpose of God really is about transformation. Transformation of individuals who've come to understand and appreciate his own character and are conforming their lives to it. A transformation that goes from the earthy things to spiritual, from carnal to lofty heavenly life. In the words of the Apostle Paul, it's to conform us to the image of his own Son, because he sent him that he might be a manifestation of himself and an example to others to follow. And you know, brothers and sisters, that's the essential essence of Jacob's life as it's been recorded. God could have chosen through his penman to record all kinds of other things about this man's life, and it would have lost that focus. But God has very carefully chosen what he has in order that it might focus on the transformation that all of us are going to have to go through in our lives. And that's why our theme this week, as its sub-theme, is the transformation of Jacob to Israel. And I was really impressed by that poster, because there we have Jacob at the top and Israel below, and his life is the whole process of turning a Jacob into an Israel. Because as Jacob, he was not much used to God. Even though in the early part of his life, he desired to worship God, and he was a godly and upright man, God still had many things to do with him. And it wasn't until he had transformed him and he became Israel that he was actually going to be of use to God in the end. And so it is with us. God is going to take us through a transformation in our lives if we will come with him. If we will prevail long enough with God to do that, and Jacob was one of those, a monumental example of one of those who tenaciously held on through that long process, who never ever let go, as it were, of God through all of those changes, as difficult as they were and as unpleasant as some of them were in his life. And finally God brought him and pronounced him as a prince. You know, there's a number of people, not that many, in the scriptures whose names were changed. It's, I suppose, a fairly rare event where we find someone's name changed. And you might like to just try and make a list of them. But this you'll find, that every time a person's name is changed, there is some significance in it. There is something that is being memorialized, something usually quite important that's being memorialized by that change. Because name stands for character. Just as God's name stands for his character, so it is when names are changed, it's something to do with a transformation. And so this man, whose name was changed from Jacob to Israel, has been memorialized in the divine record as a man that is going through a transformation from a Jacob to an Israel, from a heel catcher to a prince with God in the end. And that transformation, brothers and sisters, is not according to our plan, just as it wasn't according to Jacob's. You know, Jacob had plans in his life. He had mapped all kinds of things out, and he made all kinds of decisions along his life. He knew exactly, when he was a young man, exactly what he wanted to do and where he wanted to go. And God took him on an entirely different path, all over the place, he would have thought. And things happened in his life that he just never, never expected and didn't know how to handle. But that's what transformation is about too. It's not about what we decide we need to change. Because this process of transformation is God's process. And it's him that's doing the changing. And sometimes in our lives, as Jacob found, it's a very painful process. It's not a quick process. For him, it took a lifetime. And it required, on his part, incredible faith, patient endurance, trust, submission to God, And all of those things didn't come natural to Jacob, just like they don't come natural to us. For us to submit and trust in the will of another, even if we say it's God, is not an easy thing. No matter what we think and say to other people, brethren and sisters, you and I know that that is not an easy thing to do. To trust the will of another. And that's what Jacob had to learn. And so this great struggle that he went through, in the end, had a purpose. As Paul later said in Corinthians, our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. You know, it must have been a vision that looked beyond that at times for Jacob that helped him to prevail when at certain stages of his life that it must have been very difficult for him to keep going. But you know, brothers and sisters, when we stand back and have a look at Jacob as an individual in the divine record, there's a few things that jump out at us. This man is an absolute giant among men and women of Old or New Testament times. He is a giant of faith. Do you know that he's mentioned 3 times in Hebrews 11? 3 times. Not once, 3 times. We'll have a look at a couple of those a little later tonight. He's mentioned in the scriptural record more times than Abraham, more times than Isaac, in fact, more times than both of them combined. He is one of those monumental characters that spreads right across the scriptures. We find him in the Psalms, in the prophets. We find his life and experiences memorialized and put before the nation time and again. And yet, his life is painted in Genesis as a great struggle. Not a pointless struggle, though. And that's really the encouraging thing about this man's life. It's not a pointless struggle. It was a struggle, sure. But it's a struggle that he was going through because God was in control. And part of the time, he didn't know what God was doing. And he had to let go and let God lead him. And that was a very, very difficult thing for him to do. And at times, he didn't want to let go, so God forced him to let go by just the sheer circumstances that he was in, that he might learn to trust. But that struggle was all about change in his life. It was about this transforming process that God was taking him through and wanting to change him from a Jacob to an Israel. You know, not only that, his life in the Old Testament particularly is highly typical of Israel's national struggle to find God. Not only did the nation inherit his name because he was the father of those sons who became the 12 tribes of Israel, we find both his earlier name Jacob and his later name Israel used of that whole nation. But the nation, no matter what they're called, find that they're going through the same experiences. And Jacob's own experiences, as they're recorded in Genesis, are highly typical of the experiences of the nation at various stages. And so the prophets constantly pull out the language of Jacob's life to describe what the nation was going through and would yet in the future go through. You know, in the struggle that Israel is involved in is not yet ended. They are still in the struggle. And we often hear the term, you know, the day of Jacob's trouble is not yet over for natural Israel. And true it is that it isn't over. You know what Paul said? We know these words well, so we don't need to turn to them. But I've put them up there on the screen for you just to focus on for a moment. Because Paul here, talking about Israel, natural Israel, he said, "And so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob." You know, that single verse is only one of many, many illustrations throughout the scriptures where the two names of this man, Jacob and Israel, are used right alongside each other for very significant purpose. So here, Israel and Jacob have been chosen by Paul to be used in the same verse. But what's he really saying? so Israel, all Israel shall be saved. Yeah, it's true. All Israel shall be saved. And then he quotes, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer that shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob, not from Israel. You see, what Paul is trying to do by drawing this statement from the prophets is to say, there's got to be a deliverer come that's going to help Jacob in his natural state, naturally thinking of himself and trying to work things out for himself. That is the nation of Israel, as we know them, that's trying to sort things out their own way. The deliverer's got to come first and is going to have to turn away and transform Jacob before God can save them. Now, in the ultimate, that's true. But here, Paul just uses those two names, Israel and Jacob, to illustrate the point of the change. And so his whole argument is built upon this transformation that happened in Jacob's life and the name change that obviously memorialized. But Jacob's experience is not just limited to the nation of Israel. I'd like you to come back to Deuteronomy, or come over to Deuteronomy for a moment. Because here, at the end of Moses' life, Moses made sure, in the words that had been delivered to him here, that Israel never ever forgot this man. In Deuteronomy chapter 26, and at verse 1, it says there in verse 1 of Deuteronomy 26, and it shall be when thou art come into the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee for an inheritance and possesses it and dwellest therein, that thou shalt take out of the first, that shall take of the first of all the fruit of the earth, which thou shalt bring of thy land that Yahweh thy God giveth thee, and shall put it in a basket, and shall go unto the place which Yahweh thy God shall choose to place his name there. And thou shalt go unto the priest that shall be in those days, and say unto him, I profess profess this day unto Yahweh thy God, that I am come unto the country which Yahweh sware unto our fathers to give us. And the priest shall take the basket out of thine hand, and set it down before the altar of Yahweh thy God. And thou shalt speak and say before Yahweh thy God, a Syrian ready to perish was my father. He went down into Egypt and sojourned there with a few and became there a nation great and mighty and populous. And so he goes on to say this whole series of things about what happened when they were down in Egypt and how God came along. You have a look at verse 8. And Yahweh brought us forth out of Egypt. Verse 9. And he hath brought us into this place and given us this land. Verse 10, and now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which thou, Yahweh, hast given me, and set them before me. So it seems like a very strange thing that they had to do. They, at the time that they brought the first fruits, the tithes that they were to gather, they were to do this every third year. Verse 12 tells us that. And they were to come up, and after they'd laid down that gift for God, which was to be used in the service of the temple, they were to say these words that we read. It started in verse 5 and goes right down to verse 10. Great long thing that they had to remember to say every time. And look how it started. A Syrian ready to perish was my father, and he went down into Egypt. Now, who of us would ever have called Jacob a Syrian ready to perish? I certainly don't think I would have ever called him a Syrian ready to perish. Probably would never have even thought to have called him a Syrian. But it's talking about Jacob here. And the point really that God was making is that to the nation here was that if God had not blessed him and had not blessed you, these people who were now bringing their basket from the first fruits that they had, They would never have been able to do that. They would have been nothing. Probably they wouldn't have even been in the land. And they would have, as a nation, been completely decimated long before this. And so they were being forced back to think about their beginnings and all that God had done along the way, that God had actually brought them out of Egypt and he'd brought them into the land because they'd cried and they were under oppression and God responded to all that. So this whole statement they were to make was all highlighting God's work amongst the nations, but it started with Jacob, who's called here not Jacob, but a Syrian who was ready to perish. Well, what's the end of all Syrians, brothers and sisters? What is the end of a Syrian who was outside of the pile of Israel that had nothing to do with the nation? Well, a Syrian, all Syrians were going to perish. And now their own father of the nation is called a Syrian who was ready to perish. You know, Jacob left the land that had been promised, where he was dwelling as a sojourner, as he himself said, with just my staff, running for his life from Esau, and he went back to Syria. And when he came back from Syria, he had two bands of people with him, and God had greatly blessed him in that time. So at some stage, he was, in fact, a Syrian who had Syrian connections because his mother was a Syrian. Mother had come from Syria. And though we probably wouldn't have thought to have called him a Syrian ourselves, here the divine record picks up this characteristic of him and says that he was a Syrian as good as dead. But if it hadn't been for God in that man's life, that whole nation, as they came up year by year, would not have even had the opportunity to do that. And everything that had happened to them in the time from when Jacob was first alive and before they themselves had come into existence was all the blessing of God all the way. And so they were coming to acknowledge not only God's good hand in their life, but God wanted at that very point, when they acknowledged that, he wanted them to focus back on their roots and to focus on this man who was at the very base of them as a nation, their father Jacob, whom it calls a Syrian, and not just to think of him as the great patriarch Jacob, but to think of him as a Syrian whom God took through this whole great long journey and eventually found the blessing of God. So when they came up to bring their tithes, brethren and sisters, by God telling them they had to say that every time, he was directing them back for themselves to focus on this man's life and to think, God really has greatly blessed our father. This, our father, Jacob, has gone through this long progression, this long process that resulted in the end with the blessing of God. And he was now asking them to follow that journey that their father had gone. You know, he didn't just leave it at that. It wasn't just that Israel had to, at this particular time, focus on the nation, on the forebear of their nation. Come over to Hosea. Because the prophet here extends this even further. In Hosea chapter 12. In Hosea chapter 12 verse 2. Yahweh hath also a controversy with Judah, and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his doings will he recompense him. Now notice it's very interesting that he calls the nation here Jacob. It's not that often, but through the prophets you find on occasions the nation being called Jacob. And it's very, very apt here that he does so call him Jacob, because God's got a controversy with this nation. And he's going to punish them, we're told. He's going to punish Jacob according to his ways. In other words, he's going to do exactly what he did with their father before. That is, God's not going to just bring all these indiscriminate judgments because they've been evil. He was going to let the consequences of their doings, which is what this is meaning, according to his ways, punish him according to his ways. He's going to let the consequences of his actions come back upon his head so that he might learn from them. And the experiences of Jacob's life were just like that. Jacob made all kinds of choices, and the consequences of that rebounded, and we might have almost called them punishments. Well, here, Hosea says that's what God used it for. God used it to chastise him and to punish him. And what he was going to do was exactly the same. God was going to allow the consequences of the nation as it was at this time to teach and to shape and to influence them. But read on, verse 3. And he took, and now he's talking about Jacob, he took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power with the angel, he prevailed, he wept, he made supplication unto him, and he found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us. So now he's using the life of Jacob to drive a point. I'll give you another translation. This is Rotherham's translation in verse 3. Just makes it a little clearer. In the womb he took his brother by the heel. And by the way, that to take by the heel in the Hebrew is the word Jacob. It's exactly the meaning of Jacob's name. And so there we've really, in the start of verse 3, in his immaturity, in his spiritual immaturity, that was in the womb here, the prophet says, by a figure, he was Jacob. He took his brother by the heel. But his manly vigor when he grew up, spiritually when he grew up, the authorized version says that he had power with God. And that phrase, power with God, is Israel. It's just Jacob's other name. So there, in that one verse, verse 3, we find Jacob and Israel hidden in that verse. And really, what the prophet is actually saying is that we've got initially in his immaturity, he was acting like a heel catcher, he was a Jacob. In his manhood, when he grew up, finally, when he came to spiritual maturity, he became an Israel or a prince with God. And here was a summary of the struggle, the transformation that was taking place in his life. And God's saying, now you're going to have to go through this same process, Israel, and I'm going to allow the consequences of your actions to come back upon you to teach you, just like I did with Jacob. But the prophet doesn't stop there and say, this is just a lesson for Israel, because he goes on at the end of verse 4 to say that there he spake with us, not just Israel. This has now been lifted generations out, and all of those who in future generations would read this are being told the same lesson. And so we too, like Israel in the past, and the natural descendants of Jacob have been directed back to that man's life and the experiences that he went through. Here Hosea is actually pointing his life at us too. There are lessons there for us to learn. We don't have to be physically and naturally connected by bloodlines to Jacob to learn the lessons of his life. Hosea says it's there for anyone. And the prophet is speaking here through to us. We'll return to Hosea a little later, not tonight, in one of our other studies, and have a look in a little bit more detail at some of the things that Hosea is actually saying there. But when we look at the divine picture, excuse me, and the portrayal of the selection of the history that we have recorded in Genesis, what we find is this, that the life of Jacob dominates the latter part of Genesis. Now we know that Genesis is the book of the beginnings, and everything that's basically important in the Bible has its seedbed in Genesis. And so you have, you know, a chapter devoted to this, and this idea is introduced and so on. And then we find Abraham with a great chunk of Genesis devoted to him, how important must his life actually be. But when we get to Jacob, brothers and sisters, the last half of the book of Genesis is devoted to Jacob's life. Well, you might like to debate that. And some would, because as soon as you look at Genesis, the book of Genesis, Jacob's life isn't the doesn't seem to be the central focus right through to the end, because we find that quite a large chunk of Genesis devoted from chapter 25 onwards, devoted to Jacob's life, and then Jacob gets into his old age, and then we find that Joseph comes in onto the picture. But you know, when you read right through the whole of the section on Joseph, Jacob hasn't disappeared. And right at the end, when the chapter closes on Joseph's life, Jacob's still mentioned right at the end. Because the whole of the work of Joseph was all about saving the house of Jacob. And so this story that starts back here with Jacob as a young boy goes right through to the end of Genesis. Quite an amazing thing. But even though that's the case, it's still very selected parts of his life that we find. Now, if you have a look at that chart on the screen at the moment, what you'll notice is that these, I don't think you can see them very clearly down the back, but there's some red numbers here. And by the way, I'll give you, during the week, I'll give you a chart that's a little similar to this, but it's actually got a bit more detail on it, on paper. It shows here Abraham, Isaac, Jacob and Joseph's lives and their interconnection. But the red numbers down here are the chapters of Genesis that relate to the period of Jacob's life. Now, one thing stands out immediately, that we know very little in the early part of his life. The first 50 to 60 years of his life, we know very little. In fact, we know two incidents, essentially. Then, in this period here, there and somewhere in here, which is sort of a bit undefined, right through to here, a period of something like 40 years, there is an enormous concentration of detail. And you would think when you read some of that, why do we need to know all of this stuff? Because that's the bit of Jacob's life that God wants us to focus on. He doesn't want us necessarily to focus. He tells us a little bit about this. But this is the critical part of Jacob's life, that God is focusing attention on. Because here we find this approximately 40-year period from when he was about 57 to the time he's about 97, when he was in Syria, by the way. It's a period from when he left Bethel and came back to Bethel on his way back to the land. His life is painted as a man during that period that's wrestling to live a life by faith and to find God in the everyday experiences of his life. And during that point in his life, God is transforming him from a Jacob into an Israel. And it's that part of his life that God sees fit to show to us. And there's many, many other things that are completely left out of his life. And we'll find that during our week together, we're going to spend a bit of time around that. Of course, we'll have a look at some of those incidents that happened before that 40-year period started. But it's still very instructive to know that that's where God focuses his attention. So, his life is portrayed as we said, a man that was wrestling to live a life by faith and to try and read the providential hand of God in his life. And there's some things, obviously, that we can identify with, because living as we do in a far-off age from when there has ever been any divine revelation, we too struggle to understand and to know and be sure that God actually is with us and wanting us to go in this particular direction or that. And it's difficult at times in our lives to see the hand of God in the ordinary things. Sometimes, brothers and sisters, the things of everyday life seem so ordinary that they couldn't really have anything to do with God. Well, that's what Jacob also thought, and he found differently. He found that God actually worked through those very simple and ordinary things of everyday life. And it became a very difficult thing for him to accept that God knew best in every situation. And we're no different, are we? Well, when we look at Jacob's life from his own point of view, come back to Genesis. Come back to Genesis 47 and verse 9. Because here, we have, near the end of Jacob's life, a statement of how he saw his life. Verse 9. It's the time when he's brought before Pharaoh. Pharaoh was the ruler of the world at the time. And anyone else would have come before that great majesty, that ruler, with awe and dread, not Jacob. Jacob was Jacob. He'd been under the hand of God all his life, and here he is near the end. And Pharaoh said unto him, verse 8, how old are you? Clearly he looked about 400. Pharaoh was amazed. Jacob says in verse 9, said unto Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out before him. An amazing encounter. What struck you from verse 9? What is it that struck you? Someone can say. Few, yeah. We might not think 130 years as being few. Is anything else strike anyone else? Wasn't like his fathers. He didn't think he was anywhere near as good as his fathers, as long as his fathers. Days of the years. Long days of the years. Pilgrimage twice, I think, is the really key to that verse. In one sentence, before the ruler of the world. The ruler of the world that built permanent monuments that you never, ever, ever could shift, and the winds of the desert could never shift, and had put all his trust in everything he could build to that man who is the most powerful man in the world, Jacob says, I'm a pilgrim. Few and evil have been my days. I'm just passing through. I'm a pilgrim, and I'm a worse pilgrim than my fathers. That's how he saw his life. At the end of his life, brethren and sisters, the dominant thing in his mind was that all his life he'd been waiting, just passing through, going somewhere else. You know, I reckon that is one of the most dramatic challenges that you and I, living in our age, could ever take on board. Could we possibly say, when we get to the end of our age, I just wonder what would happen if we had a chance to stand before the Queen and she asked us a question, whether our answer would actually witness, not just to the truth, brethren and sisters, but to the reality of what our lives mean now, that we don't care anything about the stuff and everything else that everyone else puts trust in. But that he was only concerned to pass through, because as Paul said in Hebrews, he saw something up ahead. He saw a city that had foundations, and he was trudging through this weary wilderness until he got there. And he even told Pharaoh that. Amazing. Well, that's how he saw his days. Few and evil. You know, most of Jacob's life was characterized by just ordinary things. And this few and evil. You know, the word evil there doesn't mean, you know, he was wallowing in sin. It means unpleasant circumstances, things that were not very nice. And you know that most of the evil came from his family? Did you know that? Here's the evil in Jacob's life that he was talking about. He grew up in a divided home. He lived with the murderous hatred of his brother. Eventually he was driven out of home because of that. How many of us have ever experienced anything like it? It was injustice of a ruthless employer that went on for years and years and years. He was deceived over the matter of his wife. Those two wives brought division and tension and trouble that never left that house. There was the anguish over Rachel's barrenness. He suffered the loss of the only son in his family who wanted to grasp hold of the truth, and the others got hold of him and killed him. And then his daughter left the truth and went to the world. And all of his sons were rebellious. I mean, look at the man's life. No wonder he said, few and evil. But look at it. It's nearly all close home. And that's where God tests us. He's not going to take us out and make us jump off the pinnacle of the temple. The trials of this man, just like ours, brothers and sisters, are going to happen just in the very ordinary circumstances of our lives. As Brother Robert Roberts once said, crowns are won and lost in the common things of life. The very common ways of life. We may view our circumstances as very insignificant and unimportant, and what happens tomorrow and yesterday as of no consequence to anyone. But God watches every single thing that happens in our lives, brothers and sisters. He is concerned in the lives of all his saints, and he will use those very ordinary circumstances in family life, in ecclesial life, in our working life, in our interactions with other people, brethren and sisters, to change us for his kingdom. And that transformation process that was happening in Jacob's life happened in the very, very simple and ordinary things of his life. And in the light of that, Brother Robert Roberts concluded in talking about Jacob's life, and he said, the attitude of wisdom is to therefore open our eyes toward God in all our ways. Never, never think that God is not in everything that's happening, and the circumstances that we come across in our lives are there for our testing and for our reaction. God is showing us a way. He's wanting us to change and giving us opportunity. Well, I think, brethren and sisters, that above all else, Jacob emerges out of the divine record as a man of faith. There are three separate references, as I said a moment ago, to him in Hebrews 11. And we have this seal in one of them. And I'm only going to read it to you. You'll probably be able to cite the words around it. But this is the essence of one of them, where I must admit, even though I've said there's three references to Jacob in Hebrews 11, his name is not mentioned in all three of those references. He's mentioned a couple of times, but in this one, he's lumped together with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as being the heirs of salvation. And to mentioning him with Abraham and Isaac, it says that God is not ashamed to be called their God. Now, you know, in the Greek, that really should be translated, and it has a bit more meaning to us in this sense. It should be translated that God is not ashamed to be surnamed their God. And that's exactly what God did. God called his name and attached theirs to his. When his memorial name was pronounced back in Exodus to Moses, God said, my name is Yahweh Elohim, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, and the Elohim of Jacob. So his memorial name was not just Yahweh, it was Yahweh Elohim, the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And those three names were attached to God's, and his purpose was linked to those. Now you know what Jesus did with that? When he was in dispute with the Pharisees in Luke 20, he said, those men are as good as raised. They are in the kingdom because God is not the God of the dead. And he calls himself the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They must live. In fact, they live in God's eyes. So there's the seal on his faith. That's this man that we find here that we're going to look at this week, and who is memorialized in Hebrews 11 as a man whose life is absolutely sealed as being in immortality, according to Jesus' use of that particular scripture from the Old Testament. So we're in great company when we are here to consider this man's life. And of course, we've got a great deal to learn from him. Well, All we want to do tonight now is to just look at how he's introduced into the record with this very brief little incident. Let's come back to our reading. And we're not going to spend a lot of time here, but come back to our reading in Genesis chapter 25. And it's always an interesting and instructive thing to note how individuals are introduced by God to us in the first instance. And verse 19 of Genesis 25, we read, "And these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac." Now, if you'd covered over the next verse, what would you have expected? If I read verse 19 to you, "These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Esau and Jacob," or it might have even left Esau out because he was a write-off, and it might have just gone straight to Jacob, and then Jacob begat, and then they begat. That's what you'd expect when you're going to read a genealogy, isn't it? Well, you might have expected that, but Genesis, on a couple of occasions, when it starts off saying this is the generation of, and you expect the genealogy like it gives in some occasions, on a few others it doesn't, and it just makes us prick up our ears and say, what's going on here? Because here we read in verse 20 that Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian in Padan Aram, the sister to Laban the Syrian. Why on earth did we need to know that in the genealogy? Why is Rebekah given here? Because hardly ever we find women being introduced into a genealogy. And why does it tell us all this detail about her when we already know that? Because Rebekah's already come into the record before. We know where she came from. We know who she's related to. So why did the record have to tell us all this again? Well, this is so, so critical to this genealogy that's coming through Abraham, Isaac, and eventually to Jacob. And there's something that the divine penman saw was very, very important to tell us before it even mentioned the name Esau and Jacob. And that was that Isaac married Rebekah. And not that he just married Rebekah, but who Rebekah was. And did you notice that she's called the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister to Laban the Syrian? Twice she's called a Syrian. That connection is being made. It's clearly not just by accident. This is an important thing just for us to notice here, because here's this connection back to a Syrian. Do you know Rebekah is never called a Syrian before this? She's never told that she's the daughter of a Syrian. Now, we know that she was the daughter of Bethuel. We know that Laban was her brother. But now it's being labored that she is a Syrian. And so, what's that really saying? It's telling us right from the outset, before we even get Jacob's name mentioned, that here was a problem. You remember, this has already come up when we looked at Deuteronomy chapter 26. Moses said he's a Syrian ready to perish. Did Moses understand what had been written here? I think so. Now, don't let's get this wrong. Rebekah was a very great woman of faith. But she was a Syrian by birth. And Jacob inherited Syrian characteristics and a nature that came from her. Now, Rebekah, we know, was barren for a 20-year period, verse 20 and verse 26. If you look at those two together, you'll see that she was barren for about a period of 20 years, which was a tragedy beyond description almost in those days, a tragedy at any time, but especially for a woman of faith in the line of the seed, for her to actually be barren and to feel that the whole of the purpose of God was not happening because of her, must have been an incredible thing that was put upon it. Do you know, every single generation of the patriarchs, every single generation, the women were barren. Because God was trying to stress that man would prove powerless to produce the seed unless God was involved. That this seed of promise was exactly that. He had promised a seed and it would be his work. And in his time, the seed would come, and not by the will of man. And not by the strength or the ingenuity of man, because God was trying to teach the patriarchs and us on this far off distant time that really he is in control and not us. Though we think at times we are, we make all kinds of decisions as though we're in control, and they began to and tried to and found that God was in control, because all God had to do was to stop the womb of one of those women and their whole life changed. Everything that they'd been told now was put on hold, and they had to wait until God took over. Have a look at verse 22. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of Yahweh. And Yahweh said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. The one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." So this is the first indirect reference we have to Jacob, and it's struggling in the womb with Esau. So they're locked in combat. Well, not combat, but in a struggle. You know what that word, Hebrew word struggle means? It means to crush, to oppress, to bruise, or to break. It's a very strong word. And this was no ordinary experience that Rebecca was going through here at this stage in bearing those two children, because there was a very, very grave struggle going on within her. And how highly significant that was to become. Typically, because as we know, there were two kinds, as the angel even said here, there were two kinds of people that were going to come out of that. Two manner of people, two races from thy body shall be parted. They'll be divided because they were nothing like each other. Totally different. One spiritual, one carnal. And it almost happened from birth. And even in the womb, they were struggling. And that was going to be the start of this enmity that was going to continue and would characterize all their future relationships. And inevitably, if it was said here that the elder shall serve the younger, inevitably that was going to bring problems and more tension. It divided that house, you know, that statement. That statement divided that house for 50 years. And we've got Rebecca and Isaac, who are great towering monuments of faith in their own right, and who were buried together in Machpelah and will be in the kingdom without any question. Absolutely no question about that. And yet, that issue divided those two for 50 years and brought tension into that house, that statement. And this struggle that began before their birth lasted all their days. Verse 24, "And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red all over like an hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came out his brother, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them." Interesting. Might have just lost power here for a moment. Sorry about that. Okay, that will probably make its way back up. Now, so we've got here in verse 24 to 26 that Esau comes out first. You know, what would have happened if Jacob had been born first? If the spiritually minded one had been born first, what would have been different? You could certainly understand that there would be a very different pattern of history, because the pattern of history turned on the fact that Esau came out first and Jacob second. So right from the start, God was in control, and it was that circumstance that turned the whole tenor of the history of that nation from this point onwards. Well, the word Esau comes from a Hebrew root word that means to make, and He had hair all over his body as if he was a fully grown, mature man. And it's as if to say, being called Esau, that he was already made. He was already finished when he was born. He was born like he was. And in fact, that was just like that man. As he came out of the womb, so was he. He never made one change. Okay, he grew physically, but he never changed from a spiritual perspective all his days. He was the epitome of the flesh through and through, red, fully formed, unchanging, just like the flesh. Excuse me just for a minute. I'll have a go at having a restart. Look at that. Here he is, Esau. Red all over. Child of the flesh, called Edom. We know of him that he was a man of the field, a cunning hunter, a city builder. He's called in Hebrews an irreligious man. He was unaware of providence. He married outside the truth. He hated God, and God hated him. Quite an amazing description. But what about Jacob? Jacob took, as we're told here, took his brother's heel in his hand as he was born. And for that reason, at the time of his birth, he was called Jacob because he caught him by the heel. And we often say that Jacob's name means a supplanter or a deceiver, and by extension it does, but it just literally means heel catcher. It comes from the word to grab by the heel. He was actually given that description by Esau in chapter 27, verse 36. We'll look at later, not now. But he became a huge contrast, both spiritually and physically, with Esau. Though he was a heel catcher, God transformed his life. He was moldable through his life and became eventually a prince with God. He was an upright, godly man, a tent dweller. He loved the promises. He's aware of the providence of God. He only married when his father had given him directions about what to do and what family to go to that had some semblance of the truth there. And he loved God, and God loved him in the end. Well, it's quite an amazing thing, because we find that as it goes on in verse 27, the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. Esau was a cunning hunter. The phrase means skilled in game. He lived for the excitement of the hunt and the kill. You know, there are only two men in the whole of Scripture that are called hunters. He's one, and the other one is Nimrod, of whom it said he was a mighty hunter in the face of Yahweh, that is, against God. And he likewise went his own way, lived his own life, defied God, built cities, built technology, just went his own way. It was completely against everything to do with the truth. And here we find this man too, exactly the same path. But Jacob, in contrast, was a plain man dwelling in tents. Well, that word plain is a very bad translation. It's never, ever translated plain. The Hebrew word is never translated plain any other place but here. In fact, it's almost always translated as perfect or upright or undefiled. It's the same word that's used of Noah to describe him as perfect in his generations, or of Abraham and of Job. Who was said he was a perfect man. If you want to know how to live the truth, you go and have a look at that man. That's how he's described here, as he was growing as a boy. So he was an upright and godly young man, single-minded, sincere, and we told, the two things we're told about him, he was upright and godly, and he was dwelling in tents. Well, just hold your hand there for a minute and flip over to Hebrews 11 to the second of those mentions of this man in Hebrews 11. In fact, it's the first one in the chapter, and it occurs in verse 9. It says, by faith he sojourned in the land of promise. If you look at the context, the he there is Abraham. It's just been talking about Abraham. By faith Abraham sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Now, in that verse, we have the dwelling in tents associated with the acceptance of the promise. Because Abraham didn't have to dwell in tents. Abraham was rich enough not to dwell in tents, but he chose to dwell in tents simply because of the promise. So dwelling in tents became a symbol of acceptance of the promises. That they had loved the promises and they were prepared to live a pilgrim life and dwell in tents, even though everyone in that region where they were was dwelling in tents. That's not the point. The point here is the linkage to that. For he looked for someone who would have a city that had foundations, as the verse goes on to tell us. You know, I don't think that's even the most interesting thing about that verse. The most interesting thing is that it says that Abraham dwelt in sojourning, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob. Now, if we just shoot back for a minute, look at that. What does that tell you? Abraham dwelling with Isaac and Jacob in tents that were all lovers of the promise. Well, there was only a 15-year period of Jacob's life when Abraham was alone. So if that verse is saying that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were all together dwelling in tents as heirs of the promise, we know this, that Jacob was a mighty, exceptional young man. So by the time he was 15 years of age, he had already made an absolute commitment about where his loyalties lay and that he was in love with the promises and he wanted them above all else despite what his brother wanted. What an amazing thing. He gave first place to spiritual things. And the very, very first thing we find when we go back to Genesis and just conclude, the very first thing that we're told in the lives of these two boys is this little incident right at the end of this chapter when, as we know, Esau comes in craving as though he's starving hungry. He's been out on a hunt. And he comes in and says that he's about to die, verse 29. And Jacob sowed pottage and Esau came in from the field and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. And he tells us in verse 32 he's at the point to die. Well, if we read it, verse 34, as soon as he'd had a bowl of soup, he was fine, off on his way. So he was nothing like ready to die. This was just a typical case of the flesh exaggerating so badly. Here he was coming and saying, "He's at the point of die. You must do this for me." And so Jacob saw an opportunity where Esau was prepared, because of the sort of natural thinking he was prepared to sacrifice all future well-being for present gratification. That's what the flesh is really like. He was swayed by his senses, not by faith, because he didn't care anything about the promises. He didn't want that. All he wanted was the thrill of the here and now, which is typical of all those who love this present world and tread underfoot holy things. But Jacob, in verse 31, says, he said to Jacob, "Sell me this." Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I'm at the point to die. What property is my birthright to me?" And verse 33, and Jacob said, "Swear to me this day." And he swore unto him, and he sold him his birthright. See, Jacob actually knew what Esau was like. He knew that he was dishonest. That's why he made him swear here. But Jacob's a bit scheming here. He took advantage of this situation to get something that he didn't have, that he wanted. Because he saw that that birthright not only brought with it a double portion of the inheritance, he saw that it brought with it the priestly function in that household. And it had responsibilities that were connected to the truth, that were connected to the promises made to Abraham and later to Isaac. And he, of all things in his life, wanted to be attached to that. But on contrast, his brother sold for one meal, all that. He didn't care. And he's called an irreligious or a profane man by Paul. But verse 34 tells us, and Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage, his lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Verse 34, there's an incredible Bible echo that we haven't got time to pursue now. But what does that make you think of? He did eat and drink and rose up to play. Doesn't say to play. That doesn't make you mind go back to, or go on forward to Sinai when the Israelites, Moses was in the mount and they were worshipping the golden calf. They sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And those words come back through the scriptures in various ways. At times, in Hezekiah's day, they were eating and drinking and making merry. You know, brothers and sisters, that ought to be very interesting to us, because Jesus at the end of the Olivet prophecy said that our day would be characterized by eating and drinking and all the cares of this life, going our own way. The same thing, the Esau attitude. There he was, despising God and walking out. But Jacob has now got the birthright. It was a thing that he really desperately wanted, because he knew that it was associated with the mighty covenant that was made to Abraham. And here was, at even a young age, however old Jacob was at this stage, we don't know, but here was his ambitions that were all in that direction. And despite his faults, brothers and sisters, and despite the fact that he was scheming here, his driving ambition of life was to be associated with the purpose of Abraham's God. And this incident here starts the drama of his life from the divine perspective. The drama of Jacob's life was all about him loving the truth and wanting to live a life by faith. But as soon as he tried to do it, brethren and sisters, it brought enmity. It brought enmity immediately, externally, in a struggle with Esau that just didn't go away. In fact, it didn't go away all his life, basically. But you know what? That wasn't the only struggle. There was another struggle that he was not so conscious of at this time. Another struggle that was not external, but internal, that was more serious, more dangerous, and more difficult to fight. A struggle that came about from his birth, from his heritage, because his mother was a Syrian. You know, brothers and sisters, this is where we enter the absolute oneness with this man. Because, yes, when we come to the truth, we find there's enmity that comes about because we love spiritual things and others don't. And that will inevitably cause enmity externally. But because of our birth, because of the nature that we bear, we have another struggle that's just as serious, in fact, more serious. More dangerous, more difficult to fight, just like Jacob. And Jacob had not yet come to grips with the seriousness and the reality of that. And God was going to use that very incident where the Syrian in him had come to the fore and grabbed that birthright. God was now going to use that to lead him to face up to that serious struggle within and to learn to deal with the Syrian in his life. You know, the rest of Jacob's life, from a divine perspective, is all about that. It's not so much about Esau, the external enmity. It's more about the Syrian within that he had to learn to deal with, because it was there that God needed to make change. God knew he couldn't change Esau, but he could change Jacob. Until he recognized and hated the Syrian characteristics in him and wanted with all his heart to attach himself to the God of Abraham and of Isaac that went before him. And so we're going to follow Jacob through that process as God takes him to try and get the Syrian out of him.